He knows everyone's still awake, waiting for me. There's more room than in the Mersive, but the bunk is still small and cramped. At least there's space to move, and plenty of beds for the barrows, with even a bit of living space around the doorway. A single window cut high in the far wall is closed tight against the rain, and the sky seems a bit lighter. Dawn is coming. Yes, it is, I think, taking in the overwhelming amount of red. Scarves, rags, scraps, flags, banners, red on every surface and hanging from every wall. I should have known it would come to this. Gisa sewed dresses for silvers once. Now she painstakingly makes flags for the Scarlet Guard, decorating whatever she can find with the torn sun of resistance. They aren't pretty, with uneven stitches and simple patterns. Nothing compared to the art she used to weave. That's my fault, too. She sits at the little metal table, frozen with a needle in her half-healed claw of a hand. For a moment she stares, and so do the rest. Mom, Dad, Trainee, staring but not knowing the girl they're looking at. The last time they saw me, I couldn't control myself. I was trapped, weak, confused. Now I am injured, nursing bruises and betrayals. But I know what I am and what I must do. I have become more than we could ever have dreamed. It frightens me. Mare. I can barely hear my mother's voice. My name trembles on her lips. Like back in the Stilts, when my sparks threatened to destroy our home, she is the first to embrace me. After a hug that isn't nearly long enough, she pulls me to an empty chair. Sit, baby, sit, she says, her hands shaking against me. Baby. I haven't been called that in years. Strange that it returns now, when I'm anything but a child. Her touch ghosts over my new clothes, feeling for the bruises beneath, like she can see right through the fabric. You're hurt, she mutters, shaking her head. I can't believe they let you walk after, well, after all that. I'm quietly glad she doesn't mention Naercy, the arena, or before. I don't think I'm strong enough to relive them. Not so soon. Dad chuckles darkly. She can do as she pleases. There's no let to it. He shifts, and I notice more gray in his hair than ever. He's thinner, too, looking small in the familiar chair. Just like Shade. Shade is common ground and easier for me to talk about. You've seen him? I ask, letting myself relax against the cold metal seat. It feels good to sit. Trami gets up from his bunk, his head nearly scraping the ceiling. I'm going to the infirmary now. Just wanted to make sure you're... Okay is no longer a word in my vocabulary. Still standing. I can only nod. If I open my mouth, I might tell them about everything. The hurt, the cold, the prince who betrayed me, the prince who saved me, the people I've killed. And while they might already know, I can't bring myself to admit what I've done. To see them disappointed, disgusted, afraid of me. That would be more than I can bear tonight. Bree goes with Trami, patting me gruffly on the back before following our brother out the door. Killorn remains, still silent, leaning against the wall as if he wants to fall into it and disappear. Are you hungry? Mom says, busying herself at a tiny excuse for a cabinet. We saved some dinner rations, if you want. Though I haven't eaten in I don't even know how long, I shake my head. My exhaustion makes it hard to think of anything but sleep. Gisa notes my manner, her bright eyes narrowed. She pushes back a piece of rich, red hair the color of our blood. You should sleep. She speaks with so much conviction, I wonder who the older sister really is. Let her sleep. Of course, you're right. Again, Mom pulls me along, this time out of the chair, and toward a bunk with more pillows than the rest. She nannies, fussing with the thin blankets, putting me through the motions. I only have the strength to follow, letting her tuck me in like she never has before. Here we are, baby. Sleep. Baby. I'm safer than I've been in days, surrounded by the people I love most, and yet I've never wanted to cry more. For them, I hold back. I curl inward and bleed alone, inside, where no one else can see. It isn't long before I'm dozing, despite the bright lights overhead and low murmurs. Killorn's deep voice rumbles, speaking again now that I'm out of the equation. Watch her, is the last thing I hear before I sink into darkness. Sometime in the night, somewhere between sleep and waking, Dad takes my hand, not to wake me up, but just to hold on. For a moment, I think he is a dream and I'm back in a cell beneath the bowl of bones. That the escape, the arena, the executions were all a nightmare I must soon relive. But his hand is warm, gnarled, familiar, and I close my fingers on his. He is real. I know what it is to kill someone, he whispers, his eyes far away, two pinpricks of light in the blackness of our bunk. His voice is different, just as he is different in this moment. A reflection of a soldier, one who survived too long in the bowels of war. I know what it does to you. I try to speak. I certainly try. Instead, I let him go, and I drift away. The tang of salt air wakes me the next morning. Someone opened the window, letting in a cool autumn breeze and bright sunlight. The storm has passed. Before I open my eyes, I try to pretend. This is my cot, the breeze is coming from the river, and my only choice is whether to go to school. But that is not a comfort. That life, though easier, is not one I would return to if I could. I have things to do. I must see to Julian's list to begin preparations for that massive undertaking, and if I request Cal for it, who are they to refuse me? Who could say no in the face of saving so many from Maven's noose? Something tells me the blood-eyed man might, but I push it away. Gisa sprawls in the bunk across from me, using her good hand to pick a few loose threads from a piece of black cloth. She doesn't bother to watch as I stretch, popping a few bones when I move. Good morning, baby, she says, barely hiding a smirk. She gets a pillow to the face for her trouble. Don't start, I grumble, secretly glad for the teasing. If only Killorn would do that, and be a little bit of the fisher boy I remember. Everyone's in the mess hall. Breakfast is still on. Where's the infirmary? I ask, thinking of Shade and Farley. For the moment, she's one of the best allies I have here. You need to eat, Mare, Gisa says sharply, finally sitting up. Really? The concern in her eyes stops me short. I must look worse than I thought, for Gisa to treat me so gently. Then where's the mess? She huffs as she stands, tossing her project down on the bunk. I knew I'd get stuck babysitting, she mutters, sounding very much like our exasperated mother. This time she dodges the pillow. The maze of the barracks goes by quicker now. I remember the way, at least, and mentally note the doors as we pass. Some are open, revealing empty bunk rooms or a few idling reds. Both tell the tale of Barracks 3, which seems to be the designated family structure. The people here don't look like soldiers of the guard, and I doubt most of them have ever been in a fight. I see evidence of children, even a few babies, who fled with their families or were taken to Tuck. One room in particular overflows with old or broken toys, its walls hastily painted a sickly yellow, in an attempt to brighten the concrete. There's nothing written on the door, but I understand who the room is for. Orphans. I quickly avert my eyes, looking anywhere but the cage for living ghosts. Piping runs the length of the ceiling, carrying with it a slow but steady pulse of electricity. What powers this island? I don't know, but the deep hum is a comfort reminding me of who I am. At least that is something no one can take away. Not here, so far from the silencing ability of the now-dead Silver Arvin. Yesterday, he almost killed me, stifling my ability with his own, turning me back into the Red Girl, with nothing but the dirt beneath her fingernails. In the arena, I barely had time to be frightened of such a prospect, but now it haunts me. My ability is my most prized possession, even though it separates me from everyone else. But for power, for my own power, it is a price I am willing to pay. "What's it like?" Gisa says, following my gaze to the ceiling. She focuses on the wiring, trying to feel what I can, but comes back empty. "The electricity." I don't know what to tell her. Julian would explain quite easily, probably debating himself in the process, all while detailing the history of abilities and how they came to be. But Maven told me only yesterday that my old teacher never escaped. He was captured. And knowing Maven, not to mention Ilara, Julian is most likely dead, executed for all he gave to me, and for crimes committed long ago, for being the brother of the girl the old king truly loved. "Power," I finally say, wrenching open the door to the outside world. Sea air presses against me, playing in my ratty hair. "Strength." Silver words, but true all the same. Gisa is not one to let me off the hook so easily. Still, she falls silent. She understands her questions are not any I want to answer. In the daylight, Tuck seems both less and more ominous. The sun shines bright overhead, warming the autumn air, and past the barracks, the seagrass gives way to a sparse collection of trees. Nothing like the oaks and pines of home, but good enough for now. Gisa leads us across the concrete yard, navigating through the bustle of activity. Guardsmen in their red sashes unload mobiles, stacking more crates like the ones I saw in the Mersive. I slow a little, hoping to get a glance of their cargo, but strange soldiers in new uniforms give me pause. They wear blue, not the bright color of House Osanos, but something cold and dark. It's familiar, but I can't place it. They look like Farley, tall and pale, with bright blonde hair, cut aggressively short. Foreign, I realize. They stand over the cargo piles, rifles in hand, guarding the crates. But guarding them from who? "Don't look at them," Gisa mutters, grabbing onto my sleeve. She tugs me along, eager to get away from the blue soldiers. One in particular watches us go, his eyes narrowed. "Why not? Who are they?" She shakes her head, tugging again. "Not here." Naturally, I want to stop, to stare at the soldier until he realizes who and what I am. But that is a foolish, childish need. I must maintain my mask, must seem the poor girl broken by the world. I let Gisa lead on and away. "The colonel's men," she whispers as soon as we're out of earshot. "They came down with him from the north." "The north?" "Lakelanders," I reply, almost gasping in surprise. She nods, stoic. Now the uniforms, the color of a cold lake, make sense. They are soldiers of another army, another king, but they're here with us. Norta has been at war with the Lakelands for a century, fighting over land, food, and glory. The kings of fire against the kings of winter, with both red and silver blood in between. But the dawn, it seems, is coming for them all. "The colonel's a Lakelander, after what happened in Archeon." Her face pains, though she doesn't know the half of my ordeal there. "He came to sort things out, according to Tremi." There's something wrong here, tugging at my brain like Gisa tugging at my sleeve. "Who is the colonel, Gisa?" It takes me a moment to realize we've reached the mess. A flat building just like the barracks. The din of breakfast echoes behind the doors, but we don't pass through. Even though the smell of food makes my stomach rumble, I wait for Gisa's answer. "The man with the bloody eye," she finally says, pointing to her own face. He's taken over. Command. Shade whispered the word back on the Mersive, but I didn't think much of it. Is this what he meant? Is the Colonel who he was trying to warn me about? After his sinister treatment of Cal last night, I have to think so. And to know such a man is in charge of this island and everyone on it is no particular comfort. So Farley's out of a job. She shrugs. Captain Farley failed. He didn't like that. Then he'll hate me. She reaches for the door, one small hand outstretched. The other has healed better than I thought it would, with only her fourth and fifth fingers still oddly twisted, curled inward. Bones gone wrong, in punishment for trusting her sister in a time long ago. Gisa, where did they take Cal? My voice is so low I'm afraid she doesn't hear me, but then her hand stills. They talked about him last night, when you went to sleep. Killorn didn't know, but Trainee, he went to see him. To watch. A sharp pain shoots through my heart. Watch what? He said just questions for now, nothing that would hurt. Deep inside, I scowl. I can think of many questions that would hurt Cal more than any wound. Where? I ask again, putting a bit of steel in my voice, speaking like a silver-born princess should. Barracks 1, she whispers. I heard them say, Barracks 1. As she opens the door to the mess, I look past her, to the line of barracks marching toward the trees. Their numbers are clearly painted, black against sun-bleached concrete. 2, 3, 4. A sudden chill runs down my spine. There is no Barracks 1. 6. Most of the food is bland, gray porridge and lukewarm water. Only the fish is good, cod taken straight from the sea. It bites of salt and ocean, just like the air. Killorn marvels at the fish, idly wondering what kind of nets the guard uses. We're in a net, you idiot. I want to shout, but the mess is no place for such words. There are Lakelanders in here as well, stoic in their dark blue. While the red-uniformed guardsmen eat with the rest of the refugees, the Lakelanders never sit, constantly on the prowl. They remind me of security officers, and I feel a familiar chill. Tuck is not so different from Archeon. Different factions vie for control, with me right in the middle. And Killorn, my friend, my oldest friend, might not believe this is dangerous. Or worse, he could understand and not care. My silence persists, broken only by steady bites of fish. They're watching me closely, as instructed. Mom, Dad, Killorn, Gisa, all pretending not to stare, and failing. The boys are gone, still at Shade's bedside. Like me, they thought him dead, and are making up for lost time. So, how did you get here? The words stick in my mouth, but I force them out. Better I ask the questions before they start in on me. Boat, Dad says gruffly around a slurp of porridge. He chuckles at his joke, pleased with himself. I smile a little for his sake. Mom nudges him, clucking her tongue in exasperation. You know what she means, Daniel.
I'm not stupid, he grumbles, shoveling back another spoonful. 2 days ago, around midnight, Shade popped up on the porch. I mean, actually popped.
He gestures with his hands, snapping his fingers.
You know about that, don't you?
I do.
Near gave us all a heart attack, what with the popping and him being, well, alive.
I can imagine, I murmur, remembering my own reaction to seeing Shade again. I thought us both dead, in some place far beyond this madness, but like me, Shade had merely become someone, something, else to survive. Dad continues on a roll now, literally. His chair rocks back and forth on squeaky wheels, moving with his wild gestures.
Well, after your mom stopped crying over him, he got down to it. Started throwing stuff in a bag, useless stuff. The porch flag, the pictures, your letterbox. Didn't make no sense, really. but it's hard to ask anything of a son come back to life. When he said we had to leave, now, right now, I could tell he wasn't joking, so we did.
What about the curfew?
The measures are still sharp in my head, nails in my skin. How could I forget them, when I was forced to announce them myself?
You could have been killed.
We had Shade and his... Dad struggles for the right word, gesturing again. Gisa rolls her eyes, bored with our father's antics.
He calls it jumping, remember?
That's it, he nods. Shade jumped us past the patrols and into the woods. From there we went to the river and a boat. Cargo's still allowed to travel at night, you see. So we ended up sitting in a crate of apples for who knows how long.
Mom cringes at the memory.
Rotten apples, she adds. Gisa giggles a little. Dad almost smiles. For a moment, the gray porridge is Mom's bad stew. The concrete walls become rough-hewn wood, and it's the Barrows at dinner. It's home again, and I'm just Mare. I let the seconds tick by, listening and smiling. Mom jabbers about nothing, so I don't have to speak, letting me eat in quiet peace. She even chases away the stairs of the mess hall, meeting every eye that swings my way with a vicious glare I know firsthand. Gisa plays her part, too, distracting Killorn with news of the stilts. He listens intently, and she bites her lip, pleased by his attention. I guess her little crush hasn't gone away just yet. That leaves only Dad, glopping through his second bowl of porridge with abandon. He stares at me over the rim of his bowl, and I glimpse the man he was. Tall, strong, a proud soldier, a person I barely remember. So far from what he is now. But like me, like Shade, like the guard, Dad is not the ruined, foolish thing he seems. Despite the chair, the missing leg, and the clicking contraption in his chest, he's still seen more battles and survived longer than most. He lost the leg and lung only 3 months before a full discharge, after near 20 years of conscription. How many make it that far? We seem weak because we want to. Perhaps those are not Shade's words at all, but our father's. Though I've only just come into my own strength, he's been hiding his since he came home. I remember what he said last night, half hidden in dreams. I know what it is to kill someone. I certainly don't doubt it. Strange, it's the food that reminds me of Maven. Not the taste, but the act of eating itself. My last meal was at his side, in his father's palace. We drank from crystal glasses, and my fork had a pearl handle. We were surrounded by servants, but still very much alone. We couldn't talk about the night to come, but I kept stealing glances at him, hoping I wouldn't lose my nerve. He gave me such strength in that moment. I believed he had chosen me and my revolution. I believed Maven was my savior, a blessing. I believed in what he could help us do. His eyes were so blue, full of a different kind of fire. A hungry flame, sharp and strangely cold, tinged with fear. I thought we were afraid together, for our cause, for each other. I was so wrong. Slowly I pushed the plate of fish away, scraping the table. Enough. The noise draws Killorn's eye like an alarm, and he swings back around to face me. All done? He asks, glancing at my half-eaten breakfast. In response, I stand up, and he jumps to his feet along with me, like a dog following commands. But not mine. Can we go to the infirmary? Can. We. The words are carefully chosen, a smokescreen to make him forget who and what I am now. He nods, grinning. Shade's doing better by the second. Well, Barrows, care for a trip? He adds with a glance toward the closest thing he has to a family. My eyes widen. I need to speak to Shade to find out where Cal is and what the Colonel plans for him. As much as I missed my family, they'll only get in the way. Luckily, Dad understands. His hand moves swiftly beneath the table, stopping Mom before she can speak, communicating without words. She shifts, adopting an apologetic smile that doesn't reach her eyes.
We'll come along later, I think, she says, meaning much more than those few words. About time for a battery change, isn't it?
Bugger.
Dad grumbles loudly, tossing his spoon into his bowl of muck. Giza's eyes flicker to mine, reading what I need. Time, space, an opportunity to start untangling this mess.
I've got more banners to sort out, she sighs. You lot go through them pretty fast.
Killorn shrugs off the good-natured jab with a laugh and a crooked smile like he's done 1,000 times.
Suit yourselves.
It's this way, Mare. Condescending as it may be, I let him lead me through the mess. I'm careful to make a show of it, playing up a limp, keeping my eyes downcast. I fight the urge to stare back at everyone watching. The guardsmen, the Lakelanders, even the refugees. My time in the Dead King's court serves me just as well on a military base, where once again, I must hide who I am. Then I pretended to be Silver, unflinching, unafraid, a pillar of strength and power called Marina. But that girl would be right next to Cal, confined in the missing Barracks One. So I must be Red again, a girl named Mare Barrow, a girl no one should fear or suspect, reliant on a Red boy, and not herself. Dad and Shade's warning has never been so clear.
Leg still bothering you?
I'm so focused on faking the limp, I barely hear Killorn's concern. It's nothing, I finally respond, pressing my lips into a thin line of forced pain. I've had worse.
Jumping off Ernie Wick's porch comes to mind.
His eyes glitter at the memory. I broke my leg that day and spent months in a plaster cast that cost both of us half our savings.
That wasn't my fault.
I believe you chose to do it.
I was dared.
Now, who would have done such a thing? He laughs outright, pushing us both through a set of double doors. The hallway on the other side is obviously a new addition. The paint still looks wet in places, and overhead the lights flicker. Bad wiring. I know instantly, feeling the places where the electricity frays and splits. But one cord of power remains unbroken, flowing down the passage to the left. To my chagrin, Killorn takes us right.
What's that? I ask, gesturing the opposite way.
He doesn't lie.
I don't know.
The Tuck Infirmary isn't so grim as the medical station on the Mersive. The high, narrow windows are thrown open, flooding the chamber with fresh air and sunlight. White shifts shuttle back and forth between patients, their bandages blissfully clean of red blood. Soft conversation, a few dry coughs, even a sneeze fill the room. Not a single yelp of pain or crack of bone interrupts the gentle noise. No one is dying here, or they have simply died already. Shade isn't hard to find, and this time he isn't pretending to sleep. His leg is still elevated, held up by a more professional sling, and his shoulder bandage is fresh. He angles to the right, facing the bed next to him with a stoic expression. Who he's addressing, I can't tell yet. A curtain surrounds the bed on two sides, hiding the occupant from the rest of the infirmary. As we approach, Shade's mouth moves quickly, whispering words I can't decipher. He stops short at the sight of me, and it feels like a betrayal.
You just missed the brutes, he calls out,
adjusting himself so there's room for me on the bed. A nurse moves to help, but Shade waves him off with a bruised hand.
The brutes. His old nickname for our brothers.
Shade grew up small and was often Bree's punching bag. Tramie was kinder, but always followed in Bree's lumbering footsteps. Eventually, Shade grew smart and quick enough to evade them both, and taught me to do the same. I don't doubt he sent them from his bedside, allowing him enough privacy to talk with me, and whoever it is behind the curtain.
Good, they're on my nerves already, I reply with a good-natured smile.
To outsiders, we look like jawing siblings, but Shade knows better, his eyes darkening as I reach the foot of his bed. He notes my forced limp and nods infinitesimally. I mirror the action. I got your message, Shade, loud and clear.
Before I can even hint at asking him about Cal, another voice cuts me off.
I grip my teeth at the sound of her, willing myself to keep calm.
How do you like Tuck, Lightning Girl? Farley says from the secluded bed next to Shade. She swings her legs over the side, facing me fully, with both hands clenched in her bedsheets. Pain streaks across her pretty face, ruined by a scar. The question is easy to dodge. I'm still deciding. And the Colonel, how do you like him? She continues, dropping her voice. Her eyes are guarded, unreadable. There's no telling what she wants to hear. So I shrug, busying myself with arranging Shade's blankets instead. Something like a smile twists her lips. He makes quite a first impression. Needs to prove he's in control with every breath, especially next to people like you two. I round Shade's bed in an instant, planting myself between Farley and my brother. In my desperation, I forget to limp. Is that why he took Cal away? The words come sharp and fast. Can't have a warrior like him running around, making him look bad. She lowers her eyes, as if ashamed. No, she murmurs. It sounds like an apology, but for what, I don't know yet. That's not why he took the prince. Fear blossoms in my chest. Then why? What has he done? She doesn't get the chance to tell me. A strange quiet descends on the infirmary. The nurses, my heart, and Farley's words. Her curtains hide the door from us, but I hear the stomp of boots marching in quick time. No one speaks, though a few soldiers salute from their beds as the boots close in. I can see them through the gap between the curtain and floor. Black leather, caked in wet sand, and getting closer by the second. Even Farley shivers at the sight, digging her nails into the bed. Killorn draws closer, half concealing me with his bulk, while Shade does his best to sit up. Though this is a medical ward, filled with red wounded and my so-called allies, a little piece of me calls to the lightning. Electricity flares in my blood, close enough to reach for if I need it. The Colonel rounds the curtain, his red eye fixed in a constant glare. To my surprise, it lands on Farley, forsaking me for the moment. His escorts, Lakelanders by their uniforms, look like pale, grim versions of my brother Bree, hewn of muscle, tall as trees, and obedient. They flank the Colonel in practiced motion, taking up positions at the end of Shade's and Farley's beds. The Colonel himself stands in between, boxing in Killorn and me, proving he's in control.
Hiding, Captain, the Colonel says, fingering the curtain around Farley's bed.
She bristles at the name and the insinuation. When he tisks aloud, she visibly cringes.
You're smart enough to know an audience won't protect you.
I try to do all you've asked, the difficult and the impossible, she fires back. Her hands quiver in the blankets, but with rage, not fear. You left me 100 soldiers to overthrow Norta, an entire country. What did you expect, Colonel?
I expected you to return with more than 26 of them.
The retort lands hard.
I expected you to be smarter than a 17-year-old princeling. I expected you to protect your soldiers, not throw them to a den of silver wolves. I expected much and more from you, Diana. Much and more than what you gave.
Diana. The name is his killing blow. Her real name. Her shivers of rage turn to shame, reducing Farley to a hollow shell. She stares at her feet, fixating on the floor below. I know her look well. The look of a shattered soul. If you speak, if you move, you'll collapse. Already she's starting to crumble, leveled by the Colonel, his words, and her own name. I convinced her, Colonel. Part of me wishes my voice would shake to make this man think I fear him. But I've faced worse than a soldier with a bloody eye and a bad temper. Much, much worse. Gently, I push Killorn to the side, moving forward. I vouched for Maven and his plan. If not for me, your men and women would be alive. Their blood is on my hands, not hers. To my surprise, the Colonel only chuckles at my outburst.
Not everything revolves around you, Miss Barrow. The world does not rise and fall at your command.
That's not what I meant. It sounds foolish even in my own head.
These mistakes are her own and no one else's, he continues, turning back to face Farley. I strip you of your command, Diana. Do you challenge this?
For a brief, simmering moment, it looks like she might. But she drops her head and her gaze, retreating inward.
I do not, sir.
Your best choice in weeks, he snaps, turning to go. But she isn't finished. She looks up once more. What of my mission?
Mission? What mission?
The colonel seems more intrigued than angry, his one good eye darting in its socket.
I was not made aware of any new orders.
Farley turns her gaze back to me, and I feel an odd kinship to her. Even defeated, she's still fighting.
Miss Barrow had an interesting proposition, one I plan to pursue. I believe command will agree.
I almost grin at Farley, emboldened by her declaration in the face of such an opponent.
What proposition is this?
The colonel says, squaring his shoulders to me. From this close, I see the distinct swirls of blood in his eye, moving slowly, clouds on the wind.
I was given a list of names, of Reds like my brother and me, born with the mutation that enables our abilities. I must convince him, I must.
They can be found, protected, trained. Red like us, but strong as Silvers, able to fight them in the open. Maybe even powerful enough to win the war.
A shaky breath rattles in my chest, quivering with thoughts of Maven.
The king knows about the list, and will surely kill them all if we don't find them first. He won't let so strong a weapon go.
The colonel is silent for a moment, his jaw working as he thinks. He even fidgets, playing with a fine chain necklace hidden in his collar.
I glimpse links of gold between his fingers, revealing a fine prize no soldier should carry. I wonder who he stole it from.
And who gave you these names?
He finally asks, his voice level and hard to read. For a brute, he's surprisingly good at hiding his thoughts.
Julian Jacobs.
Tears well in my eyes at the name, but I will not let them fall.
A silver.
The colonel sneers. A sympathizer. I fire back, bristling at his tone. He was arrested for rescuing Captain Farley, Killorn Warren, and Anne Walsh. He helped the Scarlet Guard. He sided with us. And he's probably dead for it.
The colonel settles back on his heels, still scowling. Oh, your Julian is alive.
Alive? Still? I gasp, shocked. But Maven said he would kill him.
Strange. Isn't it? For King Maven to leave such a traitor still breathing?
He revels in my surprise.
The way I see it, your Julian was never with you at all. He gave you the list to pass on to us, to send the guard on a goose chase, ending in another trap.
Anyone can betray anyone. But I refuse to believe that about Julian. I understand enough of him to know where his true loyalties lie. With me. Sarah, and anyone who would oppose the queen who killed his sister.
And even if, the list is true, and the names do lead to other...
He searches for the word, not bothering to be gentle.
Things, like you. Then what? Do we dodge the worst agents of the kingdom, hunters, better and faster than us, to find them? Do we attempt a mass exodus of the ones we can save? Do we found the Barrow School for Freaks and spend years training them to fight? Do we ignore everything else, all the suffering, the child soldiers, the executions, for them?
He shakes his head, making the thick muscles on his neck strain.
This war will be over and our bodies cold before we gain a single bit of ground with your proposition.
He glances at Farley, heated.
The rest of command will say the same, Diana. So, unless you wish to play the fool yet again, I suggest you keep quiet about this.
Each point feels like a blow from a hammer, smashing me down to size. He's right about some things. Maven will send his best to hunt down and kill the list.
He'll try to keep it secret, which will slow him down, but not by much. We'll certainly have our work cut out for us. But if there's even a chance for another soldier like me, like Shade, isn't it worth the cost? I opened my mouth to tell him just that, but he holds up a hand.
I will hear no more of it, Miss Barrow. And before you make a snide comment about me trying to stop you, remember your oath. You swore to the Scarlet Guard, not your own selfish motives.
He gestures to the room of injured soldiers, all harmed, fighting for me.
And if their faces are not enough to keep you in line, then remember your friend and his own position here.
Cal, you wouldn't dare hurt him. His bloody eye darkens, swirling with deep crimson the color of rage.
To protect my own? I certainly would.
The corners of his eyes lift, betraying a smirk.
Just as you did. Make no mistake, Miss Barrow. You have hurt people to serve your own ends, the prince, most of all.
For a moment it's like my own eyes have clouded with blood. All I see is red, a livid anger. Sparks rush to my fingertips, dancing just beneath my skin. But I clench my fists, holding them back. When my vision clears, the lights flicker overhead, the only indication of my fury. And the colonel is gone, having left us to simmer alone.
Easy there, Lightning Girl.
Farley murmurs, her voice softer than I've ever heard it.
It's not all bad.
Isn't it? I bite out through gritted teeth. I want nothing more than to explode, to let my true self out and show these weak men exactly who they're dealing with. But that would get me a cell, at best, a bullet at worst. And I would have to die with the knowledge that the colonel is correct. I've done so much damage already, and always to the people closest to me. For what I thought was right, I tell myself. For the better. Instead of commiserating, Farley straightens her spine and sits back, watching me seethe. The shamed child she was disappears with shocking ease. Another mask. Her hand strays to her neck, pulling out a gold chain to match the colonel's. I don't have time to wonder about the connection, because something dangles from the necklace, a spiky iron key. I don't need to ask where the corresponding lock is. Barracks One. She tosses it to me blithely, a lazy smile on her face.
You'll find I'm remarkably good at giving orders, and particularly awful at following them.
7. Killorn grumbles all the way out of the infirmary and into the concrete yard. He even walks slowly, forcing me to slow down for him. I try to ignore him for Cal's sake, for the cause, but when I catch the word foolish for the third time, I have to stop short. He collides with my back. Sorry, he says, not sounding at all apologetic. No, I'm sorry, I spit back, spinning to face him. A little bit of the anger I felt toward the colonel spills over, and my cheeks flush with heat. I'm sorry you can't stop being an ass for 2 minutes so you can see exactly what's going on here. I expect him to shout at me, to match me blow for blow in the usual way. Instead, he sucks in a breath and steps back, working furiously to calm himself. You think I'm so stupid? He says. Please, Mayor, educate me. Show me the light. What do you know that I don't? The words beg to fall out, but the yard is too open, filled with the colonel's soldiers, guardsmen, and refugees hustling back and forth. And while there are no silver whispers to read my mind, no cameras to watch my every move, I won't go soft now. Killorn follows my gaze, eyeing a troop of guardsmen who jog within a few yards of us. You think they're spying on you? He all but sneers, dropping his voice to a mocking whisper. Come on, Mayor. We're all on the same side here. Are we? I ask, letting the words sink in. You heard what the colonel called me. A thing. A freak. Killorn blushes. He didn't mean that. Oh, and you know the man so well? Thankfully, he has no retort for that. He looks at me like I'm the enemy, like I'm some kind of bomb about to go off. He's... Killorn stumbles, unsure of the words even as they leave his lips. He's not entirely wrong, though. Is he? I spin so fast, the heel of my boot leaves black skid marks in the concrete. Would that I could leave a similar bruise on Killorn's stupid, sputtering face. Hey, come on! He calls after me, closing the distance in a few quick steps. But I keep walking, and he keeps following. Mare! Stop! That came out wrong! You are stupid, Killorn Warren! I tell him over my shoulder. The safety of Barracks 3 beckons, rising up ahead of me. Stupid and blind and cruel! Well, you're no picnic either! He thunders back, finally becoming the argumentative twit I know he is. When I don't reply, nearly sprinting for the barracks door, his hand closes on my upper arm, stopping me cold. I try to twist out of his grasp, but Killorn knows all my tricks. He pulls, dragging me away from the door and into the shaded alley between barracks 3 and 4. Let go of me, I command, indignant. I hear a little bit of Marina come back to life in the cold, royal tone of my voice. There it is, he growls, pointing a finger in my face. That, her. With a mighty shove, I push him back, breaking his grip on me. He sighs, exasperated, and runs a hand through his tawny hair. It sticks up on end. You've been through a lot. I know that. We all know that. What you had to do to stay alive with them, all the while helping us, finding out what you are. I don't know how you came out on the other side, but it changed you. So perceptive, Killorn. Just because Maven betrayed you doesn't mean you have to stop trusting people altogether. He drops his eyes, fiddling with his hands. Especially me. I'm not just something for you to hide behind. I'm your friend, and I'm going to help you with whatever you need, however I can. Please, trust me. I wish I could. Killorn, grow up, comes out instead, so sharp it makes him flinch. You should have told me what they were planning, but you made me an accomplice. You made me watch when they marched him away at gunpoint, and now you tell me to trust you? When you're in so deep with these people who are just waiting for an excuse to lock me up. How stupid do you think I am? Something stirs in his eyes, the vulnerability hidden inside the relaxed persona he tries so hard to maintain. This is the boy who cried beneath my house. The boy he was, resisting the call to fight and die. I tried to save him from that, and in turn pushed him closer to danger, the Scarlet Guard, and doom. I see, he says finally. He takes a few quick steps back until the alley yawns between us. It makes sense, he adds, shrugging. Why would you trust me? I'm just a fish boy. I'm nothing compared to you, right? Compared to Shade? And him, Killorn Warren. I scold him like I would a child, like his mother did before she abandoned him. She would shriek when he skinned his knees or spoke out of turn. I don't remember much else of her, but I remember her voice and the withering, disappointed glares she saved for her only son. You know that's not true. The words come out hard, a low, visceral growl. He squares his shoulders, fists balled at his sides. Prove it. To that I have no answer. I have no idea what he wants from me. I'm sorry, I choke out, and this time I mean it. I'm sorry for being mayor. A warm hand on my arm stops my stumbling. He stands above me close enough to smell. Thankfully, the scent of blood is gone, replaced by salt. He's been swimming. You don't need to apologize for what they did to you, he mumbles. You never have to do that. I don't think you're stupid. That might be the nicest thing you've ever said to me. He chuckles after a long moment. He pastes on a grin, ending the conversation. I take it you've got a plan? Yes. Are you going to help? Shrugging, he spreads his arms wide, gesturing at the rest of the base. Not much else for the fish boy to do. I shove him again, drawing a genuine smile from him, but it doesn't last. Along with the key, Farley gave me detailed directions to Barracks 1. As on the mainland, the Scarlet Guard still favors their tunnels, and Cal's prison is, of course, located underground. Technically underwater. The perfect prison for a burner like Cal. Built beneath the dock, hidden by the ocean, guarded by blue waves and the Colonel's blue uniforms. It's not only the island prison, but also the armory, the Lakelander bunks, and the Colonel's own headquarters. The main entrance is a tunnel, leading from the beach hangars, but Farley assured me of another way. "You might get wet," she warned with a wry smile. "While the prospect of diving into the ocean unsettles me, even so close to the beach, Killorn is annoyingly calm. In fact, he's probably excited, happy to put his long years on the river to good use. The protection of the ocean dulls the usually alert guard, and even the Lakelanders soften as the day wears on. Soldiers focus more on the cargo loads and storage hangars rather than patrolling. The few who keep their posts, pacing the length of the concrete yard with guns against their shoulders, walk slowly, easily, often stopping to talk to each other. I watch them for a long while, pretending to listen to Mom or Gisa as they chatter over their work. Both sort blankets and clothing into separate piles, unloading a collection of unmarked crates, along with several other refugees. I'm supposed to help, but my focus is clearly elsewhere. Bree and Trainee are gone, back with Shade in the infirmary, while Dad sits by. He can't unload, but still grumbles orders all the same. He's never folded clothes in his life. He catches my eye once or twice, noting my twitching fingers and darting glances. He always seems to know what I'm up to, and now is no different. He even rolls his chair back, allowing me a better view of the yard. I nod at him, quietly thankful. The guards remind me of the Silvers back in the stilts, before the measures, before Queen's trial. They were lazy, content in my quiet village, where insurrection was rare. How wrong they were. Those men and women were blind to my thieving, to the black market, to Will Whistle, and the slow creep of the Scarlet Guard. And these guardsmen are blind, too, this time to my advantage. They don't notice me watching, or Killorn when he approaches with a tray of fish stew. My family eats gratefully, Gisa most of all. She twists her hair when Killorn isn't looking, letting it curl over one shoulder in a ruby fall of red. "Fresh catch?" she says, indicating the bowl of stew. He wrinkles his nose and pretends to grimace at the gray glops of fish meat. "Not from me, Gee. My old master, Cully, would never sell this. Except to the rats, maybe." We laugh together, me out of habit, following a half-second later. For once, Gisa is less ladylike than I am, and she giggles openly, happily. I used to envy her practiced, perfect ways. Now I wish I wasn't so trained, and could shed my forced politeness as easily as she has. While we force down the lunch, Dad pours out his bowl when he thinks I'm not looking. No wonder he's getting thin. Before I, or worse, Mom, can scold him, he runs a hand over a blanket, feeling the fabric. "These are peat moth made. Fresh cotton. Expensive." He mutters when he realizes I'm standing next to him. Even in the Silver Court, Piedmont cotton was considered very fine, a common alternative to silk, reserved for high-ranking security, sentinel, and military uniforms. I remember Lucas wore it up until the moment he died. I realize now I never saw him out of uniform. I can't even picture it, and his face is already fading. A few days and I'm forgetting him, a man I sent to his death. "Stolen?" I wonder aloud, running a hand over the blanket, if only for distraction. Dad continues his investigation and runs a hand down the side of a crate. Sturdy, wide planks of wood, freshly painted white. The only distinguishing mark is a dark green triangle, smaller than my hand, stamped in the corner. What it means, I don't know. "Or given," Dad says. He doesn't need to speak for me to know we're thinking about the same thing. If there are Lakelanders with us here, on this very island, then the Scarlet Guard could easily have friends elsewhere, in different nations and kingdoms. We seem weak because we want to. With a stealth I didn't know he possessed, Dad takes my hand quickly and quietly. "Be careful, my girl." but while he is afraid, I feel hope. The Scarlet Guard has deeper roots than I knew, than any Silver could imagine, and the Colonel is only one of 100 heads, just like Farley. An opposition, definitely, but one I can overcome. After all, he's not a king. Of those, I've had my fair share. Like Dad, I pour my stew into a crack in the concrete. I'm finished, I say, and Killorn jumps up. He knows his cues. We're going to visit Shade, or at least that's what we say out loud, for the benefit of the others close by. My family knows better, even Mom. She blows me a kiss as I walk away, and I tuck it close to my heart. When I pull up my collar, I become just another refugee, and Killorn is no one at all. The soldiers pay us no mind. It's easy to walk the length of the concrete yard, away from the docks and the beach, following the thick, white line. In the light of midday, I see the concrete extends toward gentle, sloping hills, looking very much like a wide road to nowhere. The painted line continues ahead, but a thinner, more worn line branches off at a right angle. It connects the central line to another structure, located at the end of the barracks, towering over everything else on the island. It looks like a larger version of the hangars on the beach, tall and wide enough to fit 6 transports stacked on top of one another. I wonder what it holds, knowing the guard does their own share of thieving. But the doors are shut fast, and a few Lakelander men idle in the shade. They chat among themselves, keeping their guns close. So my curiosity will have to wait, perhaps forever. Killorn and I turn right, toward the gap between barracks 8 and 9. The high windows of both are dark, abandoned. The buildings are empty. Waiting for more soldiers, more refugees, or worse, more orphans. I shiver as we pass through their shadows. The beach isn't hard to get to. After all, this is an island. And while the main base is well-developed, the rest of Tuck is empty, covered only in dunes, hills swathed in tall grass, and a few pockets of ancient trees. There aren't even paths through the grass, with no animals large enough to make them. We disappear nicely, winding through the swaying plants until we reach the beach. The dock stands a few 100 yards away, a wide knife jutting out into the waves. From this distance, the patrolling Lakelanders are only smudges of dark blue, pacing back and forth. Most focus on the cargo ship approaching from the far side of the dock. My jaw drops at the sight of such a large vessel, obviously controlled by Reds. Killorn is more focused. "Perfect cover," he says, and starts to take off his shoes. I follow suit, kicking off my laceless boots and worn socks. But when he pulls his shirt over his head, exposing familiar, lean muscles shaped by hauling nets, I'm not so inclined to follow. I don't fancy running around a secret bunker, shirtless. He folds his shirt over his shoes, fiddling a bit. "I take it this isn't a rescue mission?" How could it be? There's nowhere to go. I just need to see him. Tell him about Julian, let him know what's going on. Killorn winces, but he nods all the same. "Get in, get out. Shouldn't be too hard, especially since they won't expect anything from the ocean side." He stretches back and forth, shaking out his feet and fingers to make ready for the swim. All the while, he goes over Farley's whispered instructions. "There's a moon pool at the bottom of the bunker, opening up into a research lab. Once used to study marine life, now it serves as the Colonel's own quarters, though he never visits them during the day. It'll be locked from the inside, easy to open, and the corridors are simple to navigate. At this time of day, the bunks will be empty, the passage from the docks sealed, and very few guards will remain behind." Killorn and I faced worse as children, when we stole a case of batteries for my dad from a security outpost. "Try not to splash," Killorn adds, before wading into the surf. Goosebumps rise on his skin, reacting to the cold autumn ocean, but he barely feels it. I certainly do, and by the time the water reaches my waist, my teeth are chattering. With one last glance toward the dock, I dive below a wave, letting it chill me to the bone. Killorn cuts through the water effortlessly, swimming like a frog, making almost no noise at all. I try to mimic his movements, following close to his side as we swim farther out. Something about the water, heightens my electrical sense, making it easier to feel the piping running out from the shore. I could trace it with a hand if I wanted, noting the path of electricity from the docks, through the water, and into Barracks 1.